Welcome to episode 20 of Book Banter.
This episode is brought to you by Angie's List. Next time you need someone to work on your home, repair your car, or fix your teeth, check Angie's List first. You'll find thousands of unbiased ratings on services for home improvements, car repairs, and even doctors. Let Angie's List take away the guesswork. Gain access to thousands of reviews on local service providers for home improvement, accounting, animal care, health care, and even weddings. Join Angie's List and use promo code BOOK to get 25% off your membership.
A couple of weeks ago, I was given the opportunity to attend the World Fantasy Convention in San Jose. And while I was there, I did some interviews for Book Banter. And in this episode, we'll be having my first interview from the World Fantasy Convention, and that is with best-selling author Garth Nix. In our interview, we'll be talking about how he became a writer, what he's working on right now, and the two Old Kingdom books he is also working on. We'll also talk about how he deals with all the traveling he does and how, in some ways, it can help him with his story ideas. The interview will be followed by my reviews for The Waking, Dreams of the Dead by Thomas Randall, Flesh by Richard Layman, and The Box by Richard Matheson. And now we start with my interview with Garth Nix at the World Fantasy Convention.
When did you know you wanted to write for a living?
I think I realized I wanted to write for a living. I knew I wanted to be a writer when I was about 19. I decided, you know, I want to write books, you know, and short stories. Fortunately, I had enough common sense to realize it would be hard to make a living. And so I'd need to get a day job. And that to get a better kind of day job, I'd need a degree. So, you know, so I went to university, and I was traveling around at the time. I was in the UK, and I bought his beat up old Austin 1600, and I was driving around. And I was rereading all my favourite sort of childhood books in their actual settings, and I started writing a story. Then I actually wrote half a novel. It was a good lesson. I should have finished it, because I went back and looked at it, and it was okay. I think, you know, it could have got published, particularly from like a 20-year-old. But I didn't finish it. So it's a big lesson there, you know, that finishing stuff is the first lesson. So I think it really was about then I decided that, you know, this is what I want to do. But I don't know how I knew this or, you know, how I, you know, already learned that I would need another job. And so I love books. And so I went and studied, and I got a degree, and I worked in all kinds of publishing jobs. But writing all the time, I was always writing. I'm not even, to be honest, I'm not even sure that I thought I could make a living out of it. I just wanted to do it. And then, you know, at some point I thought, you know, maybe I can make a living out of it. And then eventually I was able to. And of course, you know, that's lucky. You know, there's a lot of, you know, writers who are writing, getting published, but they still, you know, it's still not a living as such, or it's a very bad living.
Do you feel seeking a career in writing is any different in Australia than compared to the rest of the world?
No, I don't think it is any different, and I think it's become, you know, if there were significant differences, they've lessened greatly with the, you know, the advent of the internet and so on. You know, the world is, you know, so much more deeply connected these days, and certainly publishing, bookselling, reading in English, you know, is all, you know, very, very much connected. I guess there's... The differences are that, you know, it is a small country in terms of population, which is a long way away from the cult, the mainstream culture that it's associated with, you know, the Western world. So that does, you know, that probably does shape some things and change some things. But I actually don't think it really makes a difference these days as such. You know, if you set out to write and try and be published, it depends what you're doing, but, you know, fantasy and science fiction is its own country in many ways, and, you know, and we're all citizens of it, and it's deeply connected, so your geographical location, I think, is far less significant. Certainly in Australia you have the advantage that, you know, English is our native language, and English is the biggest language for publishing, so, you know, that's helpful. But otherwise, I think it's, you know, it's much the same as anyone starting out, you know, anywhere else in the West, working in English. You know.
So where did the idea for Sabriel come from?
It's always very difficult to pinpoint where ideas come from. Sabriel, I really don't know exactly, you know, where the overarching sort of idea came from, except that at the time, my grandfather was dying at the time when I first started to think about Sobril. And I think the fact that he was dying and he was taking a long time to die made me think about, you know, what happens when you die, and also what people have believed happens when you die, you know, about the, all kinds of different afterlives and heaven and so on. And I think that fed into thinking about other stuff people have believed about death, including, you know, bringing people back from death, right, and so on, and necromancers and so forth, and the whole, you know, necromancers who bring the dead back and so on. And fortunately, as it happened, I thought, well, you know, that's interesting, but I'd like to write a story, I'd like to turn it around somehow. I think, well, how can I turn it around? You know, well, what about a necromancer who doesn't bring the dead back, but, you know, makes them stay dead? Just to try to sort of change the stereotype. And so I think that's where it came from, but I, you know, there was no one sort of spark. It was, I think, the environment I was in mentally helped it come out. But that said, there are some, you know, there's some specific things in those books where I do know, you know, roughly where the idea came from, like the name Bells, you know, Sobril uses it, you know, the seven bells, as do the necromancers. And I think that came from, you know, I was thinking about, well, I want a different kind of magic, again, you know, trying to change things around a bit. And I was thinking about, you know, the banishing the dead and, you know, exorcism, and, you know, exorcism was traditionally, you know, by bell, book and candle. And I was thinking, well, you know, books, there's tons of magic books. I don't really want to do magic books with spells. And of course, I do have magic books as well. And I thought, well, candle, you know, bell, book, candle, books, no, candle. Well, candles don't seem very practical, you know, in terms of, you know, candle magic. You know, you're trying to light it.
Especially out here outside.
Yeah, well, you know, you're trying to light it and there's, you know, this horrible dead thing blows it out or whatever. You mean, you know, just, though there could be something there. I've actually come around to thinking maybe there is something, you know, candles and fire and so on. But anyway, at the time I thought, no, that's not dramatic. But bells, you know, I thought bells, you know, there's music and there's magic and music, and bells themselves are quite sort of magical and mystical. So that's, I think, where part of that came from. And the other part came from, I was reading a Dorothy Sayers mystery called The Nine Tailors. And in that murder mystery, there are these named bells that have Latin names in the church. And that led me to finding out that bells typically do have names, and actually sometimes they even baptize with names. And so that's where I got the, you know, I think that's what sparked the idea of the named bells, and which are used in, you know, in banishing the dead and so on. So, you know, that's, I can't, there's probably a thousand different ideas, and there's a couple there, mm-hmm. where I can sort of tell where they came from, looking back, you know.
And did you know Sobril was going to be more than, I mean, were there going to be more books, or was it just originally just one book for you?
Originally it was just one book. I wrote Sobril completely as a standalone book. After it came out in the US, it came out in Australia in 95 and in the US in 96, and my American publishers, it wasn't a huge success at first. You know, it actually became very successful, but it wasn't a huge success at first. But my, you know, it was critically very well received, and my publishers said, you know, I would love a sequel, but I actually didn't want to write one. I thought, oh, I'm done with that for now. And I wrote Shade's Children, which is a dystopian science fiction novel, because that was the story that, you know, I wanted to tell. But when I was about two-thirds of the way through that, I actually did have an idea for, you know, a story set in the Old Kingdom. It picked up some of the threads and so on, but in a way, you know, so Lyra Ellen and Paulson, the second and third books, are in a way sort of, you know, Sobril, the next generation, you know.
Yeah.
But I found a story I wanted to tell, and actually again there, Lyra Ellen and Paulson I wrote as one book, and it was like a mega huge book, so we split it in half. And actually, when it was split in half, I then went back in and I rewrote both halves. So it went through quite a long editorial process before it became, you know, the trilogy, though Lyra Ellen and Paulson, of course, still really are, you know, one thing. And, you know, it's a terrible thing if you've got Lyra Ellen and you finish it and you haven't got a Paulson immediately to hand.
Did you know you always wanted to write, you know, young adult children's books?
No, I didn't, actually. And to my... I still don't really particularly think about the category or where the books will be sold. Whenever I'm writing something, it seems to find its own sort of entry age level. And sometimes it's not what I think it's going to be. I have an idea for something and I think, you know, what that will be you know, a very adult story, or it will be a middle grade children's story, and then of course it ends up being something completely different. The story seems to find its own, like water finds its own level.
Mm-hmm.
I write stuff really for myself, and myself as I am now, but also myself as I was, you know, as a teenager, or as I was when I was 10 or whatever. Publishers decide pretty much, you know, where they'll go. And in many cases, you know, with the Old Kingdom books, for example, you know, there's adult editions and young adult editions, and they're exactly the same. They just get put in different parts of the bookstore.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any set plans of doing an adult-specific book at all, ever?
Not really. I mean, some of my short fiction, is more expressly adult. To be honest, I actually think it could be young adult. I mean, you know, older teenagers would have absolutely no problems with it. But in terms of, you know, where it's put in bookstores and librarians and some of the other sort of gatekeepers, you know, they might have problems with some of it. Who knows, you know. I just figure, write whatever and, you know, let other people sort it out where it goes.
So after being done with Lyrael de Borson, did you think that was it for the Old Kingdom, or...?
Well, I did at the time, because I didn't have any other story that I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, it's very interesting. You know, publishers initially at least, always want whatever worked last time. And so all my publishers were, you know, asking me to just write more, you know, in the Old Kingdom. But I'd moved on, and I had the idea for The Keys to the Kingdom, which I wanted to write. And so I started writing them. And you know, the publishers were receptive of it, but less receptive, I guess, than they would have been if I'd said I was writing, you know, Sobriel Mark II. But of course, over the years, The Keys to the Kingdom has done extremely well, and so they, you know, it's allowed me to do more of that sort of thing, you know. But now I actually am going to do a couple more Old Kingdom books, like a prequel and a sort of a sequel. But most immediately, I'm actually writing a kind of a space opera, It's a sort of coming of age in a galactic empire story. Yeah. So.
And can you talk a little about the two new books for the Old Kingdom?
Sure. One book is called Clariel, and it takes place about 600 years before Sabriel, and it essentially is the story of Claw of the Mask, the necromancer, and then greater dead creature who appears in Lyrael and Porson, and who was once in Porson herself. And so it's the story of how that happened. It's, you know, really, I guess, a story of a fall from grace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then is it those two together, or
And then the other book, which is kind of a sequel, takes place a bit after a Porson. And I'm keeping that under wraps.
Okay. So what are you looking for your readers to get out of your books?
I don't really look for readers to get anything in particular. I mean, I hope that, you know, readers enjoy the books. I guess I would hope that they get what I get out of the books that I really love, and that is an immersion in something that feels real,
mm-hmm.
even though, you know, it's not. But while you're in the book, it feels like, you know, this could actually be happening somewhere, you know, even though it's impossible. It feels like a real story that, you know, that these are real people, you know, in a real world. And, you know, that's what I would hope, that if I can achieve that and, you know, put the reader in that place, you know, I'm very happy. Otherwise, you know, I just hope they enjoy it, you know, and are entertained by them.
So, in your writing, do you have a set schedule you keep to each day?
I wrote probably half my books while I had very busy full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to just write a little bit at night, and I'd run on Sunday afternoons for 3 or 4 hours. And in only a year or a year and a half, just doing that and keeping to it fairly religiously, you can finish a book. Since about 2001, I've been a full-time writer, and I've had, you know, the luxury of not needing another job. I now treat the writing as a day job. And I have a separate office, and I walk down. I basically keep office hours. And I walk down to the office, and And to, you know, to be honest, I probably spend most mornings just sort of faffing around, you know, doing the admin and getting a coffee and, you know.
Checking the email,
replying to the email, you know, or not often as, you know. And all this sort of, you know, if you're a writer and you've been at it for quite a while, it's a small business, you know, so managing the business side of things. Mm-hmm. So I also, with my wife, I co-own a production company that is producing my brother's next animated film, Jonathan Nix. So I do some stuff with that. And the animation studio is actually the floor below my office. We have an old terrace house, so there's always stuff going on there, you know. So most mornings there's a lot of
distraction.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, like all writers, you know, I'm always, you know, looking for stuff to do that is not writing.
Right.
You know. But typically I do a little, you know, I'll do a bit of something in the morning. And often it's something I don't need to do. It'll be a story that no one has asked for, or, you know, a screenplay that is, you know, completely on spec and, you know, probably is going to be extremely difficult to sell anyway. But it's what I want to do, you know, and I find, you know, that's good for me. And then in the afternoons, I typically force myself to work on whatever is, you know, the current book that needs mm-hmm. to be done.
And so, do you have any suggestions for writers looking to get published?
I think my general suggestions, I would probably paraphrase Robert Heinlein, as it happens, and I just bought a very nice old edition of Space Cadet, one of my favourites. And you know, to paraphrase Heinlein, he said, you know, read a lot, write a lot, revise a lot, submit a lot, you know. And I think that's very good advice. You know, you need to read and read widely. And I think particularly for fantasy and science fiction authors, when you're getting started, it's important to read outside the genre. It's important to read in the genre because you need to know what's, you know, what's gone before and what's mm-hmm. going on. But in terms of, you know, equipping yourself, you know, to have a newer voice and to have the sort of full skill set, I think you need to read everything, you know, because you learn different things from different kinds of books, and you know, you bring different things from, you bring into yourself different things from different books. So I think, you know, reading widely and reading non-fiction is important too, you know, to learn how to write in different ways. And just to sort of expand your mind, I think, you know, is important. Filling up your reservoir, which you're going to draw upon for your own stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, read all kinds of stuff and read widely. Write a lot. You know, the writing is a craft, you know, and sometimes it's an art, mostly it's a craft. You know, and the more you do of it, the better you'll get at it, you know. And revise a lot. Everything needs revision. You know, there's nothing that's, well, I'd be very surprised if it's ever perfect the first time it's written. I personally do huge amounts of revision, sometimes on a sort of just a page-by-page basis. Sometimes in books, whole chapters get turfed out and, you know, done again. It's part of the process, and you can't expect that when you first put it out, you know, put it on the page, that, you know, that's it. Sometimes things go great for a while. You know, you might get three pages that need practically nothing done to them. But you should always have a look anyway. You know, mm-hmm. Leave it for a while, come back, have a look at it, see if you can improve it. And submit a lot. You know, if you want to be published, you know, of course you might want to just write just for your own enjoyment, which I think is a great thing. But if you do want to be published, you know, it's important to see if it can be published. You know, send it out. The only true test of whether something's, you know, worth being published is to see if anyone wants to publish it. You know, it doesn't matter how many relations or dear friends say it should be published. You know, that's nice, but it, you know, it's not really going to achieve anything. So you have to put it to the test. And of course, that also means coping with the inevitable rejections. And that's just part of an author's lot. You know, you will get rejected. You know, I've got tons of rejections for work I've done. You know, it's just the way it goes. And you just have to move on. If something, you know, you send something out and it's rejected 10 times, you know, you should be working on something else while it's doing the rounds, and, you know, move on. Maybe you can come back to that piece and try it again. Maybe you won't. Maybe it'll be a practice piece. But don't just keep trying to flog the same book for, you know, 3 years, or which happens, you know. It's move on, write another one. Because, you know, every new book, every new story is another spin of the roulette wheel. Pardon me. You know, anything can happen, but if you don't write it, nothing will happen.
Right.
You know, if you write it, anything can happen. To rephrase that in a positive way. If you write it, anything can happen. Yeah.
And so you already mentioned you're a Robert Heinlein fan. What else do you like to read?
I like to read everything. I mean, I am a Heinlein fan. But if you're looking at the sort of classic science fiction and fantasy authors, I'm really a fan of almost anyone you could mention. Ursula Le Guin, Andre Norton, Arthur C. Clarke, many. I'm a Tolkien fan, I'm an Alan Garner fan, C.S. Lewis, Susan Cooper. There's so many great writers and I couldn't begin to list them. Actually on my website on garthnix.com there's a link to an article I wrote for the American Children's Book Council, I think, just about my favourite books. And I did an alphabetical that had many of my favourite authors, but I could have put in another 50 for each letter probably, because I wrote it looking at the immediate shelves
mm-hmm.
in my office, but I could have been looking at some other shelves and I would have found other people for A or B or C, there are so many great writers, and I think it's important to just read lots of stuff. And again, a lot of my favourite authors are not necessarily genre authors, mm-hmm. And I include detective, thriller mysteries and so on. I love those, and I also love works of classic literature and contemporary literature too, and non-fiction authors, particularly biographers and writers of history.
Do you have any hobbies?
My hobbies are very deeply entwined in my life, I think, because books and reading would be up there. And of course, it's always hard to separate the hobby from the professional interest. I'm a very keen fisherman. In fact, I've just been on holiday and caught the largest Australian salmon I've ever caught, which I was very pleased with. And I caught a shark.
What?
Caught a wobbegong shark, which is pretty exciting. That's probably... And I'm interested in all kinds of stuff, but I'm not sure whether you could classify them as hobbies. I'm not hugely interested in sport, which makes me atypical for an Australian, except that I am sort of interested in when it's grand
important.
Final.
When it's important.
Yeah, well, I'm not interested in getting to the grand final, but, mm-hmm. When you do get to that point, it becomes interesting. I'm not sure whether it's the spectacle of it all or whatever, or it's just peer pressure at that point, you're forced to pay attention. But that probably covers it.
So, living in Australia, you probably do a lot of travelling, having to do all the book tours and things like that. Do you enjoy flying and travelling, and do you have any tricks you can recommend?
I don't enjoy flying and travelling. In fact, I like being places, I just don't like being in between. But at the same time, it's not a trick as such, but I do remind myself that, Australia to, the west coast of America... 100 years ago would have been 6 weeks in a steamship, and a little bit before that it would have been 3 months in a sailing ship. So mm-hmm. count myself lucky, it's only 14 hours. You can get through 14 hours.
Do you sleep much on planes?
Actually, I don't really sleep on planes, but I do go into this weird sort of fugue state where I actually often get quite good ideas for stories. So I guess in a way that is beneficial. So I end up being very tired and jet-lagged and cranky, but I may have had some good ideas in that strange half-asleep state, where I've been flying. I've had some very good ideas, as a consequence of that, half-alive state in the plane.
Well, you basically want to die.
you just want to be over, yeah.
So what's your reason for being here at the World Fantasy Convention this year?
I'm one of the guests of honour, which is a huge honour and privilege. Pardon me. I mean, I look back at the list of guests of honour that World Fantasy have had, and I just think, I can't believe that I will be on that list. It seems bizarre to me that I've, people think I've written enough to make it worthwhile for me to be a guest of honour. But I would be here anyway, to tell you the truth. I've been coming to World Fantasy not for that long, actually. Probably about the first one I went to was in 2003. But what I like about it is a very rare opportunity to meet so many of my peers you know, in our business, you know, in our field of industry. And it's just fantastic. Catch up with old friends, you know, meet new friends, you know. On a business side, I know I've met up, caught up with my New York-based agent, who I don't see enough, because, you know, she's a friend as well as you know, a fantastic agent. And just, I mean, some of my Australian friends I see at World Fantasy. You know, I don't see them back home in Australia because we're in very different parts of the country. But, you know, we catch up here and, you know, I buy books and I learn about new books that I, you know, I want to get, you know. And it's a great experience for, I think if you're a beginning writer, it's a great place to come and find out stuff and make connections. And you know, if you're an established writer and, you know, it's where you cement, you know, many relationships and get invigorated. I think it's from the sense of all this stuff going on. There's so much publishing and exciting books and, you know, you can feel part of the industry, which really the rest of the time, you know, is an electronic ghost, you know, somewhere off in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great to be at the sort of, you know, where the people of the industry all come together, and it's not just emails and, you know, and things on paper or the screen.
All right. Well, that leads me to my last question. If you're able to live in the Old Kingdom, which side of the wall would you live on?
Oh, that's a tough question. I wouldn't last very long in the Old Kingdom side, I can tell you. I mean, if I was able to write myself in with particular, you know, strengths or powers, I might go on the Old Kingdom side. But definitely, otherwise, I'd have to just go on the Ancelles de Aaron side, just for safety's reasons, you know, and a long way south at that, too, you know, in case something came across
off the
wall. Yeah, absolutely, off the map to the south. Yeah, down in the capital. Mind you, that's not so safe too sometimes. So, for more mundane problems, but, you know. Yeah, I don't think I'd like to actually anything I've ever written was too dangerous for me personally to live in.
Okay, well, thank you very much
that's
for the
great.
Interview.
Oh, a pleasure. Thank you. Good question.
And that was my interview with best-selling author Garth Nix. And now we move on to my review of The Waking, Dreams of the Dead by Thomas Randall. Christopher Golden, author of The Boys Are Back in Town and co-author of The Map of Moments, takes a journey away from his usual stories of the magical and horrific to tell a story of a different kind of horror and the macabre for a younger audience. Because of this, Golden is writing under the pseudonym of Thomas Randall, taking us to Japan and its complex culture and ancient supernatural legends. Kara Foster's mother was killed in a car crash, leaving her and her father alone. After years of studying Japanese culture and learning the language, they emigrate to Miyazu City, where tall and blonde Kara will be starting at a new school where her father teaches English. She is terrified, wanting to make friends and fit in, but also knowing she is a gaijin, foreigner, and will have to work hard to gain respect of others. She eventually befriends the rebellious Sakura and learns of the dark history of Sakura's sister at Monju no Chi School. On the spit of land known as Ama no Hashijate, her sister was murdered by a group of schoolgirls for having the love of a boy she had no intention of returning. And now these girls are starting to turn up dead, through mysterious circumstances, while they all appear to be having terrible nightmares involving girls without faces and terrifying cats with sharp claws and teeth, Kara included. Sakura believes it to be the haunting spirit of her sister, exacting revenge, but as Kara discovers, it is something much worse. Christopher Golden has outdone himself in taking the reader deep into Japanese culture, quick to explain how and why habits and characteristics are different, but at the same time he has a great horror story at the heart of Dreams of the Dead that will keep you riveted to the very end. And the good news is this is the first of an ongoing series by Thomas Randall, and includes the prologue and first chapter to the next book in the series, Spirits of the Know. And now my review of Flesh by Richard Lehman. Welcome to an idyllic American town where life seems simple, except for those who try to make it something else. Then Eddie, driving along in his van, attempts to run down a high school girl, innocently riding her bike. She throws herself off the road, saving her life, while Eddie crashes, burns, and dies. Meanwhile, the evil thing escapes from Eddie's body in search of new hosts. It needs a live body to feed and become stronger. The town will never be the same. Lehman creates a full cast of characters, giving the town life and realism. He doesn't hold back on graphic detail, killing off characters left and right. Hopefully the mystery will be solved and the evil stopped before the town runs out of living beings. Flesh was originally published in 1987, and at times feels a little like watching an old TV show with the dated clothing, language, and terminology. Nevertheless, for any layman fan or reader looking to discover some classic horror, Flesh is a great first step. And for my final review, we have The Box, Uncanny Stories by Richard Matheson. Having never read any of the writings of the classic horror great Richard Matheson, I was delighted to discover the relatively new release of The Box, Uncanny Stories, to tie in with the movie adaptation of the short story Button, Button. The collection, unsurprisingly, kicks off with the aforementioned story, offering an average American married couple the opportunity to win a large sum of money if they push this one button. The catch is that whoever presses the button will know that someone will die, though it will be someone they don't care about. I'm not sure how they've made a feature-length movie out of this, but the story nevertheless forces one to question one's moral compass to see if it's pointing in the right direction. At the end, there's a wonderful twist that is a signature of most of the stories in this collection. This story was also adapted as an episode for The Twilight Zone, as was another story in the collection, Mute. The stories are not just entertaining, but force one to think about their own lives and how they live them day to day. What choices would they make? Girl of My Dreams is the story of a woman who has the ability to see when people will die, and the man who uses her to blackmail them for exorbitant amounts of money. Dying Room Only, a couple who stop at a gas station, but when the husband goes into the bathroom and never comes out, things take a turn for the worst. One of the most interesting stories in the collection is Creeping Terror, all about Los Angeles being a living city that begins to send its roots into cities throughout the country, causing citrus and palm trees to grow in places where it isn't possible, as people begin getting fast cars, dressing like Hollywood stars, and even tanning. Whether you're looking for some great works by Matheson, looking for a new writer, or have a penchant for short story collections, you will thoroughly enjoy The Box, Uncanny Stories. And the thing I always like about a short story collection is if you don't like the story you're reading, then just skip to the next one. And that concludes this episode of Book Banter. I would like to extend a big thank you to Cheryl Morgan, who helped set me all up at the World Fantasy Convention. Please join me next time, where I'll be talking with author Ken Scholes, my second interview from the World Fantasy Convention. I was also able to attend a couple of panels while I was there, so I recommend checking out the Book Banter blog, which you can check out at bookbanter.net, and see some of my posts on the panels I attended. You can also check out bookbanter.net for some new book reviews that didn't appear in this episode also. Otherwise, I will see you next time, and thank you for listening to Book Banter.